Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer Alan Shartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review, we feature some of your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week. On Monday, May 10th, Joe and Alan were joined by Vice President for Editorial Development of the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson.
The number one Republican in the House endorsing what could be the number three Republican in the House, Lee Stefanik, yesterday. McCarthy officially, Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader, officially backed Elise Stefanik to replace Liz Cheney in the House leadership. "We need to be united," said the Republican leader, who worked behind the scenes for days on behalf of Representative Elise Stefanik of New York. The minority leader on Sunday officially endorsed Stefanik in her bid to oust the number three House Republican, Representative Liz Cheney, who has hemorrhaged support over her repudiation of former President Donald Trump's lies about election fraud. "Yes, I do," Mr. McCarthy told the Fox News host Maria Bartiromo when she asked whether he supported Ms. Stefanik's push to become the Republican conference chairwoman. "We need to be united, and that starts with leadership. That's why we will have a vote next week." The endorsement from McCarthy, who has been working behind the scenes on Ms. Stefanik's behalf for days, came after Mr. Trump and Representative Stephen Scalise of Louisiana, the number two House Republican, endorsed Ms. Stefanik. The move made clear that fealty to Trump and willingness to embrace his false claims of election fraud have become the ultimate litmus test among Republicans for holding a leadership position in the House. Ms. Cheney, who represents Wyoming and was once considered a future speaker, has a more conservative voting record than Ms. Stefanik, but Ms. Stefanik, a fourth-term congresswoman from upstate New York, has joined in Mr. Trump's efforts to cast doubt on the legitimacy of President Biden's victory in the 2020 election. All right, Alan, what do you think?
Well, I think the Republicans are being stupid, and here's why. The fact is that they are united in the Trump brand, right? We know that. So, but that is dumb because Trump is doing very badly in terms of the way that the American people see him. So they are, in order to keep their jobs short term, they are bowing and scraping and kissing the feet of Trump. These are the Republicans. But on the other hand, when you read the polls, they're doing very badly. Now, should they have the kind of courage that Liz Cheney has? Of course they should. Because it's the only way to get back the suburban vote, the middle class vote, but they're not doing that. In the meantime, Biden's numbers are very high. So they keep messing up in terms of the short run satisfaction that they will have of keeping their jobs while giving up the Republican claims on winning major elections. Now, will they win in Congress? Maybe, because they have, we all know, gerrymandered like crazy for some of those districts. Nevertheless, Joe, long story long. Charlie McCarthy, you may remember Charlie McCarthy.
Yeah. Said Edgar Bergen's, yes, one of three.
So who do you think? Whose dummy do you think this McCarthy is? We know he watched what happened on January 6th, pleaded for help, and then turned on his heels because he's so interested in staying where he is as the leader. That's all there is to it.
Judy Patrick, let's go to you as living in the district, as I do, of Lee Stefanik, of our representative perhaps becoming the third top Republican in the House.
Yeah, it was interesting to see that a Politico reported last week that she is telling, ultra-right Republicans that she intends to just serve one term in this position before seeking the top job on the House Education and Labor Committee. So she's like a short-term or short-timer. So from as someone in the district, I'm also you know, I'm concerned about her ability to represent the district. I'm concerned about the fact that there's a flood of money into her campaign coffers. Although, I mean, that's nothing dramatically new. She, $1.1 million flowed into her campaign in the first quarter of this year. Most of that came from Republican PAC, so but it's interesting to see the flood of money, especially McCarthy's Kevin McCarthy's own PAC sent her a lot of money. So from the district, we're worried. You know, you tend to be worried about, you know, is she going to take her eyes off, you know, her constituents' needs. It's interesting, she's no longer beating up on Andrew Cuomo. If you remember, it wasn't that long ago that, you know, that was the drumbeat for her, and now she's got her sights and her ambitions set on different things in the House.
Is her anti-Cuomo store still up? She had the...
hey,
you know,
Jim,
I don't know.
We have to look that up. Yeah. Go ahead, Alan, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, hey, Jude, borrowing a little bit here. Can she lose in that district? It was represented by a Democrat, Owens, for a long time. Now she's there. We've all heard how popular she is. There's going to be a redistricting coming up, and we don't know what that's going to look like. So the question that a lot of people are going to have is, could she get kicked out of Congress?
You know, I was talking on Facebook with some friends about this district because I think of it as a district for a long time represented by Jerry Solomon, who was a very strong Republican. Yeah. And then, you know, John Sweeney was in parts of this district. The poor district has been, you know, reshuffled and reorganized so many times. But I do agree that there are an increasing number of Democrats and independents in the district, and I think she could lose. I mean, like a lot of Republican areas, there is a diehard Trump component here. But there is a strong anti-Stefanik sentiment. I think she was able to win in part because she had moderate views for the first couple of years she was in office. And then, you know, in the last, 12 months, 18 months, you know, she has dramatically changed. She was a moderate. She was a bipartisan lawmaker for quite a bit of time, and I think that won her support even among independents and Democrats here, and that will definitely change if she continues to pursue this path, which she must if she's conference chairman.
Libby Post.
Well, you know, the redistricting is going to probably pit her against Claudia Tenney, which should be an interesting primary if they actually do that. Primary one another. And it's like, who's worse, really, between the two of them?
Yeah, but Tenney is much weaker, isn't she, Libby?
Oh, yeah, she is. Oh, she's much weaker. But, you know, it'll be the battle of the right-wing titans. And Stefanik would probably win. It's all according to how the district is redrawn and all that sort of stuff. But Judy's right. I mean, I've worked on campaigns when Jerry Solomon was the congressman, and it was, you know, Warren Washington, Saratoga, Rensselaer, Columbia, and I think Dutchess.
Right.
And now, you know, it's like Rensselaer and up to the north all the way to Ogdensburg, you know, all the way across that swath. You know, look, Elise Stefanik is an opportunist, a political opportunist. It's just that simple. Wherever she can build a power base, that's where she'll be. That's why she has, you know, embraced Trump 100%, embraced the big lie 100%, because she knows that's what her constituents want to hear, the majority of them who vote for her. That's what they want to hear. All she needs to do is drive through the district and count the Trump flags that are still up, and she knows that she's safe in that perspective. If they redistrict and they move these counties around a little bit and give the Democrats a bit more of an edge, it is possible that a blue dog Democrat like Bill Owens could win in a revamped district. I don't think it's possible for anybody to do it now, that's for sure, you know, in this current configuration. But she's just a political opportunist, and, you know, she'll go wherever she can get the most power. It's just that simple.
Sarah Rogerson.
I agree with everything that Libby just said. The only thing that I would add too, though, is that it's reflective of the polarization of the people in the district, right? If you spend any significant amount of time in the Adirondacks, camping or enjoying, you know, vacation properties or what have you, like over the last during the Trump administration, I feel like the divide became even more entrenched and vocal between people who support and reject Trump, like more amplified than even elsewhere in the state for sure, and maybe even elsewhere in the country. The volume is just so loud. There's no one's hiding anything anymore. It's either you're in this group or you're not. And she's harnessing the moment. You know, this is what Trump intended to do. This is what he gave to Republicans. And now Republicans have to figure out what they're going to do with it. And unfortunately, it looks like they're getting in line and trying to, because what they're doing is coalescing the power that they have left. It's like the last gasp of the patriarchy is going to be violent and coordinated and strategic and intentional and deliberate, because they have to be. I really want to hear more from the Republican voices that are not on board, and they're not winning the battle of rhetoric or the normative battle right now.
Well, I'm really fascinated by that, Sarah, because, and this is for whoever wants to take this aspect of the question, but we heard a lot last week in op-eds and so forth from conservative Republicans who were very upset, and a lot of editorial writers who were pointing out that, yes, Elise Stefanik's record was much weaker when it came to conservative values than that of Liz Cheney. So the only thing that they are voting on is the fact that she believes in, quote unquote, the big lie. So that to me seems short-sighted, but I'm just wondering where are all those other conservative Republicans? Are they willing to go along with this? And what does that mean for the strength of the party moving forward? Alan.
Well, it's all about Trump. I mean, you know, we can say conservative and all the rest of it, but in the end, they're scared to death of Trump. They're scared to death that he will oppose them, that he'll put a primary person up against them. And they, for want of a better word, are chicken.
Libby?
Oh, you know, I think it all comes down to that. Those, you know, you've got a handful of Republican congressmen who are calling this out as the big lie that, you know, that the tent needs to be big. We need to respect divergent perspectives, blah, blah, blah. You know, you've got a base that will believe what it wants to believe because it affirms their bias against, you know, people of color, against women, against lesbians and gays, against anything progressive. You know, and so if Trump says it was stolen, they believe it was stolen. It doesn't matter what the facts are. That's what's so outlandish about all of this. And, you know, Stefanik's going to do what Stefanik's going to do because she's a political opportunist. And Trump is going to destroy, ultimately, it may take a while, destroy the Republican Party. I can see it's going to be hard. I can see some of these more, I wouldn't call them moderate, but, you know, the folks that aren't embracing the lie, trying to maybe form a third party or create a new wing of the Republican Party. But these guys, it's all about the primaries. It's all about keeping power. It's all about winning, you know, and they see embracing Trump as the winning ticket because he's emboldened and energized the base that hadn't really been voting before. And that's what's so scary. And we have the same thing going on, you know, on the left as well, where DSA candidates, and I'm not saying that that's scary, but DSA candidates are energizing a part of the electorate that hadn't voted before. That's why we saw so many changes here in New York. You know, but they want, you know, the Republicans, the Trumpers, they want to believe the lie because it makes them feel better in the morning. That's what it's about.
A couple letters on the subject of the leadership post and Elise Stefanik. Robert says, good morning, panel. I live in her district. I've been broadcasting about her slippery, insidious choices to ride the Trump train to the White House. We must resist her effort. She signed a seditious petition denying Biden's election. Now is doubling down on that, really. Then we go to Russ. The question, it seems to me, is what unified message Mr. McCarthy wants supported. Resistance to wealth and capital gains tax increases. More likely, the Republican plan will be to run on implied support for nativism and cultural grievance without ever explicitly saying so. This should very well play in about 20 states, but it's a short-term strategy. Well, I think that's what we're all saying, right? That it's a short-term strategy.
It's short-term in terms of the national picture of what happens in the Congress and the rest. But it isn't short-term in terms of saving their own keisters. And that's the only thing that seems to matter to them. You know, they're losing in the court of public opinion. Biden keeps doing better. They keep doing worse, and yet they continue to do it.
Libby?
Well, they continue to do it because that's what they think their electorate wants. And, you know, and it might be true. Some of them will get reelected on this, but then there's going to be others who will lose in a primary to someone further to the right, and then the district that they're in will be like, yeah, I don't think so. And bring in a Democrat. There's that in the short term, but in the long term, you know, the pendulum always swings back to the center. And overall, the United States is a centrist country. And, you know, this kind of reactionary rhetoric, because it's not radical, it's reactionary.
Yeah.
You know, is not going to play well in Peoria when push comes to shove.
Judy Patrick.
You know, initially I viewed this whole Liz Cheney controversy as like a battle for the soul of the Republican Party. But I know, as it's gone on, I don't think that's right. I think the media has played that angle up way too much. If you look at Cheney's record, I mean, she's no principled Republican. She endorsed birtherism and, you know, some of the really bad things of the Republican Party in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years. I think there is a principled Republican party out there somewhere, but it's not in this current debate at all.
Sarah?
Yeah, and they don't have a Trump. Where, you know, the conservatives or the non-Trumper Republicans, they haven't coalesced around a unified voice yet. I think they're all trying to figure out who that should be. You know, all of the Elise Stefanik juniors of that part of the party are making their moves and, you know, trying to get invited to the right events and you know, doing all the things you have to do in order to grow and maintain a power base. And so I think the midterm elections will be really interesting to see what voices come out. And of course, you know, the next presidential, we'll see. It's going to be a large, messy Republican primary full of wildly divergent views. And hopefully we don't have happen what happened last time. And the Republican Party bands around a non-Trumper. That's the only hope for them going forward.
Do you have a candidate, a coalescent candidate for the others other than the Trumpers? You said that they're looking around for one. Do you have anybody that comes to your mind that might be such a person? If it's not Liz Cheney, which apparently
it's not. I think that's the problem. Yeah, yeah. I think anybody who tries it now in this climate, they're still in a big Trump hangover. Nobody can emerge strategically right now without becoming a massive target, as Libby was saying. You know, they've got a really big – the big lie is a big hammer, too, and it's going to knock out dissentive voices, so they have to be careful.
Look, you get somebody like George W. Bush, not exactly a regular liberal, and boy, you know, nobody's listening to him these days, so I don't know who it could be.
What about this Adam Kinzinger, the Republican congressman who voted for impeachment? I mean, he's very articulate. I think he has a certain amount of stamina, and, you know, he's out there fighting, you know, it seems like the good fight at this point. The other person I think is going to be on that, you know, on those debate platform next when the Republican primary debates start, it's going to be Liz Cheney.
Yep. And Larry Hogan.
And Larry Hogan, yeah.
Judy Patrick on the Roundtable panel last Monday, May 10th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel of the week in review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuc. For Tuesday's Roundtable Panel, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue welcomed investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, Tetherless World Professor of Computer Web and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, and the director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Hendler, and former associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
The FBI has identified the group behind the pipeline attack. The attack It was by DarkSide, a relatively new criminal group believed to have roots in Eastern Europe, exposed the remarkable vulnerability of an American infrastructure. This is a pipeline that basically supplied gasoline and jet fuel to the entire East Coast of the United States. And this was a huge ransomware attack. That's the new news, because yesterday many were still blaming it on Russia. Now we hear that it is this group called DarkSide. So, Jim, let's begin with you as to what this is. First, let's begin with what ransomware is and how it can screw up something like this.
Okay, so to start with, what ransomware is I break into a computer. Not me. Someone breaks into a computer and essentially locks it, or steals information or something that says, you can't have that back. You can't use your computers till you give me some money. Usually it's in the form of Bitcoin or some other cyber currency, which makes it harder to track. And it's been used against hospitals. It's been used against cities and towns and universities. So it's a fairly standard kind of attack, and people are getting better at dealing with it as a pure cyber attack. What's both interesting and scary about the pipeline attack, and I've mentioned this before on the show, is we're seeing an increasing kind of attack on what's called cyber physical infrastructure, when we give it a big name. But really all that means is things that are connected to the net but are also not just computers. So, for example, the pipeline, the electrical system, water plants. And mostly we've seen to date very small attacks on these things. So this is the first really major attack, and it's coming in the form of this ransomware. It's scary for a lot of reasons. One is because a lot of us have been saying for a long time that these systems are not as protected as much as they should be, and we're certainly seeing that play out. One thing that is interesting is this is the first major attack under the Biden administration, and they're taking a very different approach. So they've convened people. They're actually using this now to try to create some policies that will essentially tell all of the people who have these kind of cyber physical systems on which our nation depends that they have to start doing some things in the cyberspace to being more protected, reporting what's going on, things like that.
So
question, can
yeah.
I, Joe?
Absolutely.
My question would be then, do people pay off? And is there any reason that the government has put up that you shouldn't pay off and can't pay off under consequences of law?
So the answer is no. To my knowledge, there's no law. And I doubt there would be, because, you know, think about it like kidnapping, right? Some people insist we should never pay ransom. Some people say if that's the best way to get someone you love back, you do it.
Right.
A lot of it depends on the size and scale. You know, many of the attacks that were made on hospitals and things during COVID were ransomware that didn't ask for a whole lot of money, but it was a lot when you put it together, and that was all believed now to be mostly North Korean hacking, which is another whole story. You know, the other problem is a lot of these groups are peripherally attached to governments. So they're not, you know, you can't say, okay, Russia hacked us. What you can say is a group which Russia has not punished for doing this sort of thing has hacked us, right? In China, you actually can get rewards for stealing information from other countries. In North Korea, they actually have military units that do ransomware to help fund their militaries. So it's becoming a very active kind of thing. In the U.S., we've been a little bit behind legally. We've actually been pretty good in terms of protections, but people are now beginning to understand we have to really rethink this whole thing.
So when it comes to rethinking this whole thing, one of the words that really struck me in the articles that I'm reading has been the remarkable vulnerability of this system, of this infrastructure for this pipeline. So we obviously have to rethink that. In this case, do we know what the vulnerabilities were and are?
We sort of know. I mean, you have to be a little careful, right? When you're under an attack, the last thing you want to do is talk about it, right? You've seen enough police shows to know that, you know, when they're trying to find the kidnappers, they never want to say what they're doing, right? And some of these will come out in public. Most of it will only come out sort of either in the deep cyber community or maybe even in the governmental cyberspaces. I'm very happy I have a lot of friends I can no longer discuss this stuff with because they've been hired by the Biden administration to actually help solve some of these problems, or at least make them better. But, you know, the real problem we have is, you know, think about physical security, right? Most of us live in a house with locks on the doors and locks on our windows,
mm-hmm.
right? If you bought some really expensive artwork or a huge television, you might put up a little security system or, you know, if you want, you might put up a better one. If you're a bank, you have armed guards and you have much deeper things. Cyber, people have been treating it like it's all the same thing, that protecting the pipeline is like protecting your front door. And now, you know, what we're seeing is that's not true. And so some of these companies are going to have to put a lot more money into the security of these things than they've been doing in the past. It's a constant battle. You can't just say, okay, we've solved the problem. Right? Because new technologies come along that cause new vulnerabilities, and then those have to be patched. So it becomes a very active thing. And just as we need police forces to eventually provide a certain level of protection, you need the cyber people who are really going to be taking good care of your systems and really paying attention to having an appropriate level of cyber defense. Your home computer, you're probably fine with just what's provided. And you talked yesterday a lot about password vaults and things like that. I'm a strong believer in that. But, you know, when you talk about real systems like these pipelines, they need a lot more than just password protections that are better. They really need to have very significant systems that are making sure this kind of thing can't happen.
I want to bring in the rest of the group here. Rosemary, thoughts and any questions for Jim?
Where are we most vulnerable now? I have to say that the most interesting part of this story to me was the corporate-like PR statement that the hackers put out saying, look, we have principles here. We don't hack hospitals, for example. Here's how we pick our targets, and here's what happens if you pay and what happens if you don't. So what's the most vulnerable? Would it be the electrical grid? And whatever happened to backups? If the computer systems go out, we really are just dead in the water. There's nothing to go back to the way, however it was, we ran these things before there were computers.
So one is some of the backups are to run these things the way we did before computers. But of course, many of the things we rely on now in our day-to-day life you know, Joe couldn't reach me yesterday because my email was out, right? The phone would have worked, but Joan didn't have my phone number because we've always used email, right? That kind of thing. So, you know, putting the backup systems in place requires some forethought. In terms of vulnerability, we have lots of vulnerabilities in lots of places. The electrical system is a very interesting thing, and I won't go into my hour-long lecture on it that I give to my security class occasionally, but the fast answer is our electrical system is a patchwork of systems, and some of them are much more vulnerable than others. But the more vulnerable ones tend not to be the biggest, so that's the good news. But again, they're all things that could be broken into. You know, people have been worried for a long time about Wall Street and our financial system. The banks have put a lot of money and a lot of effort. They're probably the hardest thing to hack, just like a bank is a hard thing to rob. But some of the things around it, the e-trading system, some of those are less secure. The water infrastructure, the electrical infrastructure, the road infrastructure, and these pipelines. We've been very aware of these pipelines because if you think about it, imagine if this happened during a time when we had, you know, imagine there was an all-out war going on and you were trying to really bring troops and planes and, you know, military somewhere, and you had this, you know, the pipelines shut down. So, you know, people have been talking about these kind of scenarios for a long time. Here we see it really playing out and people becoming aware that this is not just a science fiction plot.
Mike?
Yeah, Jim, I wondered if you thought the government should set up a cybersecurity agency that has standards for major companies and governments and routinely do audits, kind of the way the SEC or the Fed might watch the financial stability of banks or watch over the stock market. I mean, should that be a government role now?
Yes. And the government has a certain amount of that role and does have some places in it. The CISO office, as it's called, Cyber Infrastructure Security Office, was pretty much weakened under the previous administration. That's what one of the things that's building up. So DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, is building up a lot, rebuilding their capability in this area. And there's a lot of discussion about what kind of policies we'll see in place. Of course, that gets fought back by the big companies who see how expensive this is going to be, right? It may actually be cheaper to pay ransomware now and then than to actually secure things. And we need to change that kind of thinking.
Your question, Rosemary, is this legal, right? Or is this illegal?
Well, not is it legal, is there, has the legal system kept up with the crime? What do you, if they could catch these guys, which with Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is increasingly difficult, what would they be charged with? How long would they be put away for? I'm asking this because it does not seem like the legal authority has any deterrence at all.
So there are some fairly strong laws on this. In fact, almost draconian, because they don't differentiate major hacks from minor hacks. There's no equivalent of petty theft versus grand larceny. And so everything is treated like it's grand larceny. The laws that dictate this are out of date, but they're strong. The real problem is a lot of this is international. So again, this is an Eastern European group. Even if so we know who did it in a sense, and even if we track down the members of this group and things like that, they would have to be extradited from countries who are, you know, not at the moment friendly with us and willing to extradite and things like that. So that's part of what makes this a more complex thing. Within the U.S., the penalties are fairly high, but of course, like anything else, that's a trade-off, as we see from things going on in some things like these hospitals and things like that. People are willing to take these chances, but also because in the electronic world, it's sometimes a lot harder to track it down. As you said, it's Bitcoin, cryptography, things like that. But even when it is traced to someone, you know, if it's traced to an individual hacker, some high school kid or some grown up, that's pretty easy. And they do end up in jail, and there's a lot of them. But when it's traced to an overseas, a quasi, you know, governmental agency, things get a lot more complicated.
We have letters on this. Get to these here. we'll begin with Tom. I realize that I'm oversimplifying this, but what incentives do large companies have to keep up to date and protect against this type of thing? With the pipeline, for example, gas prices go up and they still have their profits. The consumer ends up paying.
You know, it's a good question, but, you know, they pay a large penalty in publicity. They pay a penalty in having to make these fixes if they want anyone to keep using them as the provider. You know, you get into issues of monopolies and stuff, but by and large, the problem to date has been that the cost of fixing this is high compared to the probability of getting hit. But now as that probability is going up, you know, people are starting to take, are starting to take measures. You know, I use the example that in the early days, automobiles didn't have any security because who would ever steal a car?
Right.
There weren't very many. You know, once cars were everywhere and there was a major car theft rings, then people started, you know, cars came with locking systems and alarms and, you know, people would buy the club and things like that. You know, it's not a great analogy, but that's sort of where we are now. People are realizing that we're hitting a point in that curve where the costs of not doing this, either paying the ransom or having to redo your system after ransomware or some other kind of attack, is quite a pain, and that you really should be putting stuff up front.
Let's go to this letter from John. I'm a software developer, and when I worked on financial trading software 15 years ago, all financial data, all stock trades, etc., went over a completely separate internet, quote-unquote, separate dedicated fiber that the telecons had to keep in separate, tightly secured buildings. All the machines at my employers that connected to the quote-unquote finance internet were forbidden to be connected to anything else, including the public internet. The mouse and keyboard were glued to the machine, and every other USB socket was glued shut. The machines were kept in a separate locked room. All of this was required by federal law. Circumventing any of security measures was subject to immediate firing and potential federal charges. There needs to be a separate non-public networking infrastructure boiled down hard, like what the financial industry does. Comments, Jim?
You know, it's a good point. But again, we get into the cost factors. You know, for the financial industry, you know, it's still estimated there's some percentage of crime, but it, you know, compared to the cost of what it would be if this wasn't going on, you know, again, this is why your ATM works, right? You can put your card in all over the world and get cash because they've put a huge amount of time and effort into securing that. The protocols are kept secret. The systems are somewhat separate, but that comes at a huge cost. And so the question is, you know, how do we, it goes back to that previous question, who's going to pay for all this and how? And we as a society need to come to grips with that.
This letter from Saul. I worked in a mainframe environment for 30 years. Toward the end of my career, we began using servers. Are servers more vulnerable than mainframes?
Not really. One of the things that's changing some of this story is what's called cloud infrastructure. You've all heard of the cloud, but cloud is where you're sort of putting stuff out there. So for example, my Gmail is still working because Google is protecting that. And they put a lot, you know, they're a big enough company, have 2 billion mail accounts. They can put a lot of time and effort into protecting that specifically, as opposed to my Outlook mail, which, you know, even though Microsoft is a big company, it's a frequent target of hacking. So these things, you know, have these trade-offs and things like that. And servers versus mainframes are just, how big is your system? Where is it located? How is it protected? And again, there's not really one answer to that. It's right now, it's almost a wild west. You know, some banks have a guard, some don't. Some saloons, you know, are wide open to the bad guy coming in, and some have Marshall Dillon sitting there. So, you know, we really don't have a good system in place right now, and a legal system that says, you know, this is what you need if you want to be insured. This is what you need. That's changing. There is now cyber insurance out there. There's a lot of other things that, you know, are slowly starting to change this. But we as a society really have to come to grips that this is a problem we have to pay attention to.
Jim Hendler on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, May 11th. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed and evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Thursday, May 13th, Joe Donahue and Alan Chartok spent the last part of the Roundtable panel speaking with immunology and allergy specialist Dr. Jim Fagan.
So I guess the big news, and we'll start off with this, is the vaccinations of 12 to 15 years old now underway in many parts of the country, soon to be here in New York State. Certainly, as a pediatrician, I assume this is something that is nothing but good news in your department.
It's wonderful news. It's what we've been really waiting for a long time. And I'm very, very pleased that the advisory committee on immunization practices cleared the vaccine for the 12 to 15 year age. But still working on, the younger kids also, which is going to be very important. I know both Pfizer and Moderna are looking at the 2 to 11 year age group as well. But yeah, we're real excited about the fact that we can now vaccinate these adolescents. It's going to really add a lot in terms of just the general feeling of these kids going back to school in the fall, knowing that they will have been vaccinated. It's something that we've been looking forward to for a long time. So, yeah, we're very excited about it.
So is there an analogy between this and what we did when we went through with polio with the kids?
Well, obviously there is an analogy because polio was a very infectious disease that was devastating, young children many, many years ago. And you probably, like me, remember, getting, the polio shot.
It hurt.
I think we got them in school and we all lined up. They took the whole class down to the nurse's office and we got our polio shot. But yeah, I mean, vaccinations have had a major, major, major impact on the health and well-being of all of us, and especially children. If you look at the, the childhood vaccines, measles, mumps, rubella, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, it's just incredible. What the impact that these vaccines have had, and we're certainly very hopeful that the COVID-19 vaccines will have a similar effect.
So what took so long?
Well, I would argue, how'd they do it so quickly? Vaccine development takes years. It really, 3 or 4 years. We all know that. The development of the COVID-19 vaccines, the messenger RNA vaccines, was, the development of those vaccines was really expedited.
Jim, I meant with the kids. To get to the kids in terms of where their priorities were.
Well, the issue with the kids is that it's always safety and effectiveness. You want to make sure that children are not just little adults, and their immune systems are different or in a different stage of development. You want to make sure that when you give a new vaccination, that number one, it's effective, and also number one, that it's very, very safe. So the safety issues were very important, and it was like almost every other vaccine that's developed, if it's a vaccine that's not specifically for children, you always want to test it in the adult population first, and then you go down decrementally. So you go from an adult would be 18 and older. The Pfizer vaccine can actually be given to 16-year-olds. And then you want to look at the younger age groups because as you get to the – so they would look at the 12 to 15 – and then probably maybe the 6 to 11 and 2 to 5 and then 6 months to 2 years of age. And as you get to the younger children, the dosing may be somewhat different. I would not be surprised if the dosing for a six-month-old is probably half of what it is for an adult. But those are the kinds of things that need to be studied. And that's one of the reasons why you don't start out with the kids. You start out with the adults. It's for safety issues.
So my understanding, just to clarify this for, well, for myself, but also for our listeners, the vaccine so far that has been approved is just Pfizer, right? And it is the same vaccine, I got Pfizer, so it's the same vaccine that I would have gotten, right?
That's absolutely correct, yes.
Okay. So one of the things that is exciting about this is that now the largest, I believe, teachers union says that they're ready to open up, that they can now go full speed ahead for school in the fall because of this decision. What do you make of that? And I guess, you know, we were going to talk about college kids too, but certainly when it comes to schools. And then I'll give you the bonus question, which is really the stinker in the mix, which is, and how do you make sure the kids actually get vaccinated?
Well, in terms of the impact on schools, it's going to be enormous. And we're talking the 12 to 15 year old kids. So you're talking about middle school, high school. To get those kids vaccinated is going to have a major impact on really the sense of security that everyone feels in terms of sending the kids back to school in the fall. And I'm fairly confident that the 5 to 11 group will be ready by September as well. So I'm hopeful that by early fall, we'll be able to vaccinate kids as young as 5 years of age. So now we're talking about kindergarten, you know, right up through, the senior in high school and beyond. And so that, you know, that would be wonderful if we were able to do that. The second question was about, what was your second question?
The second question was about how do schools, so we're going to welcome vaccinated kids back to school. We're hearing this in a lot of colleges. How do you make sure that the kids actually get vaccinated? Will there be the same hesitancy there that there is in the adult population?
Yeah. You know, the issue is really, Joe, can you mandate that kids be vaccinated before entering school? And, you know, that's, you know, whether or not you can do that, that's not the federal government that's going to do that. It's the state governments that have the power to mandate that. And I would, you know, as a pediatric immunologist, I would love that because I think it's so important for each kid's health and well-being as well as the general population. I would love it if that were mandated. There may be issues because you have to remember this is still a vaccine that is authorized under emergency use. It's not given a general approval by the FDA yet. It's going to be a lot easier to mandate, you know, that kids get vaccinated once it is approved as by the FDA, not just an emergency use approval. But how do you guarantee that someone's been vaccinated? You can ask to see their vaccination card.
Right.
You know, and New York State has a vaccination, you know, wallet that you can put in your cell phone.
Excelsior passport. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, there are vaccination passport, they call it exactly. So there are ways, you know, that we have to document that someone's been vaccinated.
I mean, that proof obviously is important. And I guess I'm getting back to the question of, so let's go over to the hesitancy that still exists within the adult population. So the latest numbers that I have found, and you know, give or take, right, 154 million people vaccinated, 55% of the eligible population, 12 and older, and 46.4% of the total population. Is that good enough, and what do we do to up those numbers?
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful, but no, it's not good enough. You know, we talked about herd immunity before on the show, and it looks like the concept of herd immunity is something that we probably will not be able to achieve just because of the number of people around the globe who have contracted this infection. You know, it's important. We don't live in a bubble in the United States, and what's happening in India will have an impact on, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States to a certain extent. And the concept of herd immunity was that we would have to vaccinate roughly around 80%, well, do it have to be around 80% of the population of the United States immune to COVID-19, either through vaccination or by acquiring the infection. And although the numbers in terms of vaccinations are wonderful, I mean, I'm thrilled at how many people are getting vaccinated, you know, we're not at that point where it looks like we're going to be able to achieve this herd immunity. But but what we want to do is make sure that at least 75-80% of the country still gets vaccinated, because it's going to have a major impact on the spread of the virus. If the virus, you know, can't spread rapidly throughout the population because many people are immunized or immune to the virus, then it's really going to limit, obviously, numbers of infections, and will also limit, importantly, the emergence of new variants, which is another topic that we're concerned about. But I think that we have to now really focus on those folks who continue to have vaccine hesitancy for whatever reason. You know, they're going to be individuals who absolutely are adamantly opposed to getting vaccinated. And there's nothing that you can do or say. They don't want to get vaccinated, and it's their right not to get vaccinated, if they choose not to. I think it's a mistake, for them personally as well as their families and for the community. But then there are many individuals who are just nervous about it. And I think we're going to have to pay a lot of attention to that, especially now that we're able to starting to vaccinate the kids. Because, a parent may say, well, look, I don't mind getting the vaccination for myself, but, when it comes to my kids, I'm a little cautious. This is, emergency use. So right. There may be issues there. And I think it's going to be very, very important for everyone to be able to communicate effectively with those individuals and just reassuring them that this vaccine is exceptionally safe in kids. The study that was done that Pfizer looked at in their clinical trials for the 12 to 15 year group, they looked at 2,300 adolescents. Half of them received the placebo and half received the active vaccine. And what they discovered was the immune response in these teenagers was considerably stronger than the immune response documented in adults who had been vaccinated. Mm. Now, as a pediatric immunologist, I'm not surprised at that because children in general have a much more robust response. Their immune system responds more robustly than in older adults. And by the way, in those 2,300 kids, there were 16 cases of COVID-19. Guess what? They were all in the placebo group. Not wow. a single kid in the active immunization group, contracted COVID. So we absolutely have established the efficacy and the safety of the Pfizer vaccine. I have no doubt Moderna will also be accepted for that age group and will have, similar results. So I think the message that we really have to get out to everybody is this is safe and effective for young kids, and it is critically important that we're able to vaccinate these kids.
A lot of folks weighing in and have different questions. One of the ones, we got a lot on this, so I'm going to take Robert's question and just know there's about 15 other people who asked basically the same thing. Dr. Fagan mentioned that the vaccine has been given an emergency use authorization but is not yet approved. What steps need to be done to make the vaccine approved, and how long should we expect that to take? I assume the steps are being done now.
The steps are definitely being done now. It's really a question of time. The Food and Drug Administration wants to make sure that there's no long-term possibility of side effects, which we know would be extremely unlikely that we're going to see that. So it's really a question of having the vaccine out for a certain period of time, being able to administer a certain number of doses. The strict requirements to be approved to give general approval by the FDA are different than the emergency use authorization. So you're able to sort of get the EUA without having to go through, the long clinical trials that are necessary for a general approval. So there's nothing different that's going to be done. It's just a continuation of monitoring, people who are in the clinical trials to make sure that there are no surprises. Very unlikely that there will be, but that's what needs to happen to get a general FDA approval. And it will absolutely happen. I don't know personally when that will happen, but I would probably say certainly within the next 6 months, you're going to see FDA approval for Pfizer, Moderna, and probably J&J.
Should it be the right of the school system, Jim, to say, fine, you have your right, as you said before, but you don't come into school unless you have the vaccine?
I think so, Alan. That's my feeling. Because it isn't just, the individual kid or the individual family. It's the entire school. It's the other kids, it's the teachers, it's the staff, it's the administrative staff, it's the custodial staff, it's the bus drivers, it's all these people who are critical, to the function of the everyday function of school. What an individual does impacts on all of that. So yeah. I personally think it is the right. Now, it's going to be up to the states and the districts and the communities to decide this. But I think that they do have the right to mandate that personally.
The other big question that we have in the mailbag here has to do, and again, I'm just taking one letter that is representative of probably 10 or 12. This one is from Amy, and it has to do with booster shots. As a home health worker, I was in the first phase of vaccination. That means that by September or so, my immunity could dissipate. I have not heard much about booster shots, and we have other people just asking bluntly, will we need booster shots?
Yeah. No, Amy, that's a great question. It's one that we're unable to answer right now, and only time will tell. It will really depend on what is the longevity of immunity after vaccination. We think that there's evidence that the longevity of immunity after vaccination is probably going to be much longer than the immunity after natural infection, which is why we always recommend, even if you had COVID, you still should get vaccinated. You want to wait 90 days after your infection, but you should still get vaccinated because the immune response to the vaccination, it appears, will last a lot longer than the immune response to the infection. Now, how long is a lot longer? We don't know. The honest answer is we don't know yet. As an immunologist, I would say, and our experience with other vaccines, I think it would be very, very likely that immunity to the COVID-19 vaccine will last a number of years. And it could last lifetime, but the question of whether or not we will need a booster will depend on, number one, does the immunity to the vaccine begin to wane after a certain period of time? And if it does, then we may need a booster for that.
So are we seeing anything? Jim, are we seeing anything?
Right now we're not. We are seeing that immunity to the natural infection, it seems to wane after a certain period of time. But immunity to the vaccine, we don't have any evidence that that is waning currently.
Dr. Jim Fagan on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, May 13th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable or via podcast. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.